Okay, so before I begin, by a show of hands, how many people have been here for at least one or two of the other, sections in this larger framework? Part of the reason why I ask is because it's always nice to see that we get to see each other a lot. The other reason is because I wanted to make sure we understood the reason why there are six parts to this, and we're ending, I think, July 13th, or is it final date, is because Art asked for six sessions. That's why there are six. It's not because of some inherent rationale that goes to the teaching. But because he asked for six, I gave some thought to what it would mean to progress along this journey, which at least I decided to call, and we'll see if it really was this, leading a mythic life. What I wanted to do fairly quickly is catch us up. When I say fairly quickly, you know that means New York fast. Is catch us up with some of the core concepts that we've explored together before. Not pretend that what I'm saying encapsulates everyone's perspective along the path that we've taken. And recognize that there are so many different things we could touch, we could never possibly actually do what we say we're doing. Describe a mythic life over bagels six times. Most likely, were we to have enough time, I would just be listening and we would describe the different types of mythic life that each of us has explored. Because if it's a true myth, and I'm using a phrase that we'll catch up with in a second, if it's a true myth, no one can tell you what it is. If a true myth, is it on?
Yeah, I just want to turn this off. Sorry.
No problem. This will be on the Super Duper, the Tivot Shalom website, pretty soon. Whatever soon means. Okay. Now, the website of Nitivot Shalom is mythic, but in the pejorative. We'll get to the holiness soon. We have been talking about this word myth every time we get together. What I wanted to do is throw out what I thought was the most succinct explanation of the word. It comes from Sheldon. Sheldon suggested that things that I was using the word myth to describe, those things are true, even if they aren't fact. I think in one sentence that pretty much sums it up. And Sheldon, I appreciate you making it a lot easier to understand than what I typically say. And if something is true without necessarily being fact, what we have to wonder about is what does it then mean for something to be true? Why is it that we would use this word, should we use this word, with relation to Judaism? I want to say this in a generic sense. It's not, can we talk about faith traditions using the word myth? The answer is yes, we wouldn't be the first, it's done all the time. But why would we in our own shul use the word myth to describe the thing that holds us together? Isn't myth something flimsy? Isn't it the Greek pantheon? Isn't it the Battle of Troy? Isn't it all those things that when we use the word myth, what we mean is not real? Now, I'll give you the most explicit example of that type of a question. A teacher of mine, Rabbi Neil Gilman, who just retired this past year from teaching at JTS, although he'll be sticking around, thank God, for some other people, he became a rabbi of mine really quickly. And I know I shared some of this narrative before, so I'll make it sort of short, but it's my mythic narrative, so I thought I could use it as at least a diving board. So I took his class first time as an undergrad and spent the entire time yelling at him because he kept on using the word myth. And I found it harmful, personally. I found it very hurtful. It tore me up inside because I had grown up, you know, involved in conservative Judaism, fighting for it to be seen as legitimate by my Orthodox friends, which also meant fighting for it to be felt as legitimate by myself. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to explain that it was true. How to feel like it was true. And part of that is adolescence. And part of that is, I think, the maturation of a spiritual life. You know, we spend a lot of time, I think once we start questioning, we spend a lot of time questioning and then trying to figure out where our home is supposed to be. So I had that, I still have that, but I had that more intensely then. And when I got into Dr. Gilman's class, I was just hurt over and over because he kept on saying, what are the underpinning ideas? What are the underlying ideas in your mythic sense of self? And I was yelling at him. You know, I was 19. I said, don't call it a myth. It's Torah. So over the next 8 years, I took a lot of classes with Dr. Gilman, mostly because I wanted to, and I didn't realize I wanted to. I thought I was being sucked into them. They actually weren't expectations on the curriculum. I just needed to be near him, maybe because I liked pain. But over time, I watched how he treated people like me, and it was with incredible love. With incredible love. And he told of his own story. He came from not as observant family as I did, but he told stories that his father was a traveling salesman who would stay in monasteries or, you know, a convent, wherever there was a room, and he would always put his pillowcase over the Jesus that was on the wall when he put on his tefillin every morning, but he never saw himself as a religious person. And so that was, it's just mind-boggling that this is part of my teacher's internal narrative, because we always tell those kinds of stories, even if we think we're not telling them in the most glorifying ways. When I started working in Camp Ramat Nayak, not so far from JTS, I started organizing the adult learning, and I invited Dr. Gilman to come teach. So he came and did his thing. There was a traveling staff member who was from Sweden, and after Dr. Gilman had presented his talk, the student, the counselor, raised his hand. Dr. Gilman called him and he said, "Dr. Gilman, don't you think that you're finishing the work that Hitler began?" I never saw Dr. Gilman get mad until then. What the counselor was saying, and he tried to say it a few times, never making it better, what he was trying to say, I think, was, don't you understand that anything that weakens the connection of a Jew to their own identity, which means, in his mind, a weakening of Judaism, doesn't that just destroy us? Isn't that what Haman wanted to do? And Dr. Gilman said, we're done talking because this isn't a conversation anymore. Now, Gilman has told the story quite a few times, and what happened that night is he went home crying. I drove him home. He was destroyed. And he called his daughter, who was a yeshiva student at Ramaz at the time, which is a modern Orthodox yeshiva in New York City, and he said, "Rebecca, listen to what this person told me. He told me that I'm doing Hitler's work." And I know his daughter. His daughter said, "Abba, don't worry. We survived Hitler." We'll survive you. But every time he tells this story, what it does for me is it reminds me how much pain, you know, I was in, many people are in, when they hear the word myth associated with the core of a Jewish identity. So I'm saying mythic narratives, and we're going to talk about Shemot. We're going to talk about the book of Exodus. How can you do that? Why would you do that? What does it mean? So I'm also not pretending that people in the room are necessarily calm at my use of the term. But I want to make sure that at least I articulate as we try to improve on generations of our teachers. I want to make sure that I articulate that I believe that the word myth is the way to get stronger about our Jewish identity. The way to connect more clearly with our community and with the place from which we came. That might not work for everybody, but it works for me. One of the people who never used the word, but for whom I think it worked a lot, was Gilman's teacher, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. So, before we look down, and we'll look down soon, I want to give space for any initial thoughts, particularly from people who have been part of the conversations before. What we have talked about spans the question of miracle makers in rabbinic tradition, and what they believed about themselves and what we might believe about them. We talked a little bit about mystical thinkers in Eastern Europe and what it means to believe that a person can be more than just a person. I use the... Oh, this is a good frame to remind ourselves, at least to remind myself. I use the frame of Superman, Spider-Man, and Batman. And in fact, the more I thought about it, the more I was glad that I used that. A, because it's vernacular, and that makes it easier to talk about. But B, because there's a crucial difference between those three mythic figures, right? Superman is not human, and his abilities derive from not being from here. Spider-Man was human, and becomes something else through an external factor. He gets bitten by a radioactive spider. But Batman never becomes anything other than a human being. Manic obsessive... But he's always a human being. And the way they're described sometimes tells us who the people describing them are. Stan Lee must be such, an imaginative giant based on his own need to have heroes in the world. And with the new incarnation of the superheroes and all of these movies that have been coming out over the last couple of years, you see that his heroes are actually human beings who are just angst-ridden and have a lot of strength. So, initial thoughts, and I'm ready to jump in, but I wanted to give space because I throw out a lot every time I start. Right.
You know, one of the examples you gave of a myth, in a shot sense, the Trojan War was always thought of for a thousand years as a myth until Schliemann went and found that there was a Trojan War. It wasn't a myth. It was fair. And in a more allegorical sense, I think great literature is mythic and yet true in the same way that the Trojan War is literally true.
Okay.
There's no such place as Yokohama, whatever it is, county that Faulkner wrote about, but
right.
Each of the events and people that he writes about feels true, it strikes true, it says something about the human condition. And I think that's what we're talking about here, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about it now.
Right. I think it's important what you're saying. One of the things I want to point out, if people didn't hear exactly what Ron meant, and tell me if I'm misrepresenting any part of it, is that the Trojan War was thought for a long time to be myth until there was archaeological evidence uncovered, which demonstrated that there was such a thing. My question is somewhat connected to that, but I want to make sure that the nuance is clear also. The difference between what generations after the Trojan War thought about it and what I'm at least suggesting, is that the evidence of the Trojan War proved that there was such thing as a war to those who didn't witness it and tell its story as their own personal narrative. Mm-hmm. But Sinai, obviously before that, Sinai is a different kind of a story because we tell the story as our narrative, not as a historical reference that could be proven or not. And those like Bruce Feuer and other people, Feuer? I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's Filer. Thank you. Walking the Bible and Journey of Abraham, I think. What they try to do in some ways, although Filer is actually a lot better about it, I think, is they try to align historical evidence with mythic narrative. They try to take this religious identity and root it in the ground. And for me, in fact, that is the opposite of what I believe myth is supposed to do. Myth presumes that we start on the ground and we have these stories that seem to smack of history. And once we realize that they aren't true in the historical sense, that worldview is shattered. It's not to say that it has to be. But the encounter with critical thinking, I think, leaves so much behind. Maybe appropriately so, but when it comes to religious identity, my question, if we were going to make this parallel, would be, what is it for those who still worship Zeus or Neptune? What is it for them to tell the story of the Trojan War? Because as the story is told in the mythic narrative, right, in the Iliad and other places, right, the human beings were fighting side to side, and the gods were fighting above them, taking sides. And it's a primitive way of seeing war, that whichever side wins, that's the true god. So the question is, what did the victors tell of that story? Did they worship through the narrative? And I think it was a different question than worshiping through narrative wasn't the point. Worshiping the god at the cultic site was. But the parallel would be, for me, problematic, because then it would base the understanding of Judaism on the belief that it was historically based.
I think you missed the point a little bit. That what I'm trying to say is that whether the Trojan War actually occurred or not didn't matter to the mythic importance of the story.
Okay.
Whether or not Faulkner's stories occurred or not, we know they didn't.
Right.
The mythic importance of the stories is still there in a very strong way. And you're right that there's an inclination to say, oh, this event can't be proved, and therefore the myth about it is unimportant. And I think that's a faulty leap.
We're quite parallel where we are. Thank you for clarifying that. Barry.
From another angle, critical to me everything you're viewing us with as his view, and yes, there is Parshaw, which is like perfect example for my mission to the other that I couldn't finish what I wanted. It jumped out the page at me because talk about truth. I mean, the whole truth that when people had confidence in themselves, which was the same thing as faith in God, they had this ability to go into the land and conquer all this adversity. And when they didn't have that confidence in themselves, this faith in God, they were really lost. And then they can pretend to do it afterwards, you know, when they really didn't have it and nothing really happened. The truth of that story for, like, today, for me, the personal address of the people, is so clear and overarching and universal that I just, you know, I call it myth or whatever.
Right.
It was just so powerful for me that it's still, like, ringing in my ears. And one question that I still have about is, when I say prayers now, I'm moving away from that vertical Zeus kind of worship towards, I think of, towards, as you, in one way, define God as within us and without us. And it's a whole different quality for me. But that story still has that vertical aspect to it.
Yeah.
But it's also got that internalized aspect about people having confidence in themselves. So I'm still trying to, like, close that gap between those two. So I don't know if you can comment any further on that, but that's kind of where I'm going with all of this. And it's like rewriting Judaism and our story for me in a way as a much more internal, well, kind of model underpinning.
Yeah. Barry, I appreciate a lot the both the reflection on yesterday's parsha and second the challenge that it poses. I was going to say verticality and internality as the two different ways of looking at it, and bridging that is exactly, I think, the challenge before us. Because if we are comfortable, and I think many of us are, using psychological terms to explore our vision of God and what that means for community, to have an individual relationship with the deepest experience of the world, which is, I think, what comes first. Or maybe what then comes first. And to sit next to someone else who's having a radically different experience, and yet to call community the place where we meet, I think that is tremendously important. I don't know that I have the answer to what you're saying, but what I see as the most important aspect of Torah is not where it comes from. This is what Levinas said, the French philosopher. He said, what makes Torah holy is not its origin. What makes Torah holy is its infinite possibility. And that's why the meeting place can't be me. I can't be the meeting place for us. And no one can. Whoever's standing in front of me, the Shliach Tzibur, leading davening, they can't be the center of the thing. They can be the fulcrum that we all use, but we have to take turns being that. Otherwise, the mythic direction becomes centered on a personality. And I think that's ultimately what's most difficult with what was, for me, the reason I was mad at Dr. Gilman. Because I had a certain mythic sense which was centered on a personality, and that personality was most likely a combination of my mother, my father, and what I thought God was supposed to be in the sky. This pre-adolescent perfection vision which wasn't working even then. Jerry.
I've always had basically the same worldview. And I've always read the Torah or the Bible or Rousseau's Confessions the same way.
Right.
And I'm just, I'm dumbfounded because most people have such a rigid view of what they were reading, what they were connecting with.
Well, first of all, I'm always glad to be around you, and now I know why. although I had lots of reasons before. I think part of what makes it important to have this conversation then is the very basis of existentialism, which is that, you know, when it comes down to it, I'll never understand you.
Yeah, that's true.
And you'll never understand me, even though we care about each other, and we'll talk about what it is to experience the thing we call God. And if we are comfortable saying that, then the diversity of a community, if rooted in something that they agree has sacred potential, the power of the community is to help us feel less alone, no matter how alone we really are. You know, in any loss that someone sustains in this community, and I mean a physical loss in the family or friend or body, you know, I think it makes us feel very alone because who can understand this thing that I'm going through? But what's really important, I think, is to recognize that no one will truly understand and no one has the same story.
Yeah, but I guess I just have always kind of had the same relationship to words. And writing, and whether it's and it's a different relationship to that, perhaps with the Bible or something.
But good. I'm not up to change
you. You can label it existential, but I'm not sure. It's quite
no, I wouldn't label it at all. I just think that from a larger framework than the two of us and anybody in the room in combination, it's important to recognize that that's gorgeous and legitimate and profound. And not something that I've experienced in my life, but I'm glad to hear it, because it's
right. I guess so. I just don't understand how... I guess I don't understand the kind of, like, the rigidity, a lock-in to something, when there really isn't
right
evidence for that kind of lock.
So let me withdraw from this line of it, except to say that orthodoxy is totally seductive to me. There's something very powerful in the security of having answers. Even if those answers, and yours are not orthodox, even if those answers are totally unconventional, there is real security in knowing that there's an answer. The hardest thing that I ever do when someone asks me a deep personal question is tell them about the options. Because it totally pulls the rug out from under them. They want to know security. What happens next? What am I supposed to do? What, you know, and it's not that they think I have this, you know, yogi power. But they do expect me to give an answer since I've studied this stuff. So I'm glad that it's confusing where the rigidity would have a place in someone's experience, but I actually understand that place quite a lot. I think it's harder to exist in the ambiguity than it is within the security of a fixed structure that's rooted, and that you're like dying to say whatever it is.
I am, because, you know, I'm the rigid person you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I spent great weekends with Neil Gilman. He used to call me his Chabad plant.
She used to call him his Chabad plant. I can imagine that.
But here's the problem with the rigidity. There are some myths that bind us as a people. One of them is, I am the Lord your God who brought you from the land of Egypt. And now archaeology is showing that maybe that didn't happen. And I think, personally, that I could survive a lot of things that were missed and may not have happened. If we didn't have Moshe, if we didn't have an Exodus, you know, at least we have Torah. But what happens if we don't have a God that took us out of the land of Egypt? And so the other side of...
Don't answer!
So, if you're on the rigid side of the myth, it can be, there's a part of you that says, I'm not all busted.
Right.
For that reason, because I'm not sure what would be our binding if there wasn't revelation, if we didn't all receive the Torah at the same time. What would happen if that really didn't happen? And it looks like there's a chance it didn't.
I want to hold open that question. Right, for a number of reasons. One is because it's the central question. I think that what I'm pushing it as a hashkafah, as a worldview, that is the one thing that hurts the most to encounter. So I don't want to answer it, mollify, give a solution at all. In fact, I would point out that the observant J-date is called Saw You at Sinai. It's called Saw You at Sinai. And when it comes down to it, I think that is in many ways such an answer to the challenge, which is, no, I didn't. The answer is, yeah, I really want to have. And therefore, I will say that I did. I want to hold a lot of the question, though, because the same reason people turn to like J-Date or Saw You at Sinai is because there's something powerful about connecting through that idea. You can go through matchmaker.com or something else.
I've been thinking about a lot of things people have been saying. And you set forth at the beginning this binary between mythic versus historical. And thinking of historical as the record of verifiable fact is a young idea. It's not more than 600 years old, 700 years old at the most. And for a long time, people believed the stories they were told because that's what you believe. And a history is just the record of the stories. And it repeats other people's stories, and that's I use medieval literature. But the idea that those stories are insufficient, that you need to have some kind of archaeological record of being a Sinai, to have been a Sinai, that's a young idea. And I kind of want to go back to the mode in which we can say this story is real because it was told to us, because we've told it over and over again, generation by generation. That's a much older tradition of history.
Yes. Right. The telling of history, and the understanding of historiography, that every telling had its own new slant. I think that is hard to escape now. That wasn't always the way the stories were told. Let me just pose one challenge to that and move forward, even though I know people still have their hands up. I'm just not looking at them right now. One of the challenges of returning to that worldview, which in some ways is very comforting sounding, especially from much of what I'm saying, is that there would be no such thing as a woman rabbi. There would be no such thing as me as a rabbi, because I don't know who I would be. But there would likely not be such thing as a woman rabbi. There would likely not be integrated schools. There would likely not be this very conscious living of history, not just telling of it. Because if we can be critical of the path that got us to where we are, we can recognize that some of the power to shape the path is in our hands, based on the way we choose to tell the story. David Roskies is a professor of literature at the seminary, who wrote in the book The Ordination of Women as Rabbis, which wasn't supposed to be a book, and doesn't include all of the responses to the question, should there be women rabbis, specifically in the conservative movement. David Roskies said, what an exotic creature, and I don't like what he said necessarily, but what an exotic creature it is to have a woman wearing tefillin teaching us Torah. So he used the word exotic, and I don't like what that seems to say, but what he meant was the conflation of history in that one moment is incredibly powerful, and I think, I don't know, and you'll probably be able to sort of illustrate how this wouldn't work necessarily, but for me, it means that the way we tell the story and the people we empower to tell the story in the way that we've accepted it or forced it to be, is, I just thought of this phrase, sacred subversity. Right? We tell the story in a way that leads in a direction that we think is holy, even if it wouldn't have told itself that way. And by not doing that consciously, I think we wouldn't have the power to move forward with the way that we see the world. I would posit that, even if it's up for discussion, I would say that if we don't take into account our eyes, our ears, and our mouths in the transmission of story, which means our experience, if we don't take our experience into account while we're telling stories, we're ignoring the fact that we are telling them a certain way, and the choices we make impact anyone who hears and ourselves. The way that we tell the story of Exodus 19, which maybe we'll look at now, the way we tell that story has a deep impact, especially because the very beginning of it talks about the God who took us out of Egypt. Every Pesach, what is the Pesach story if we don't teach that? Well, what do we mean when we teach it today anyway? And each one of us will likely have a different answer or a different sense of confusion. So let's look down just a little bit. Not all these texts directly answer the question that we've been asking, but they're really nice quotes, I think. So here's the first quote is from a wonderful book. Does anybody need a copy and not have one? I have a few extras here. Okay. I have one extra. Michal was just waiting for you. This is from a book called God in Search of Man. It's not the easiest Heschel book, but if you're looking for one that you can open any page and have your heart blown wide open, this would be one of them. The other one is Man in Search of God. And then if you're looking to do something with it, the Sabbath, which will be likely, though I haven't decided yet, the center of the July 13th presentation. Because if myth is only something we talk about, what's the point? Okay. This is Heschel in God in Search of Man. The Bible is not an end, but a beginning. A precedent, not a story. Its being embedded in particular historic situations has not deterred it from being everlasting. Nothing in it is surreptitious or trite. It is not an epic about the life of heroes, but the story of every man in all climates and in all ages. Its topic is the world, the whole of history, containing the pattern of a constitution of a united mankind, as well as guidance towards establishing such a union. It shows the way to nations as well as to individuals. It continues to scatter seeds of justice and compassion, to echo God's cry to the world, and to pierce man's armor of callousness. So it's a beautiful quote. You can just accept that for now. I'm not telling you to agree with it, but it's a beautiful quote. Now call it into question if you... I mean, I've been looking at this for a while, but I don't want to be the one who talks a lot. Good luck to me. To you. call it into question. Heschel, I mean, we know a lot about Heschel. We never know what Heschel was feeling as he did the things he did, except that he wrote about them all the time. When he marched in Selma, Alabama, arm in arm with, well, one person separated from Martin Luther King Jr., he said he was davening with his feet when a reporter said, "Why weren't you in shul?" Because that was Saturday morning. So that's part of who he was. He would have been the next Hasidic Rebbe in the Abdur Rebbe's line. He was a survivor, even though he made it out before everything went to hell. He started as a Hasidic, you know, next Rebbe, even from childhood, went to the university, abandoned some of the purity of who he had been, started teaching in a reform rabbinical school in the United States, ended up teaching at JTS, never got the respect he deserved because he was teaching mysticism. Ooh. And changed the world, mostly after he died. So here he's writing about what he believes Torah is. So I'm not asking us to call into question his convictions. But he would have been the first to say he's just a human being. And ideas are meant to be shared. So, does this work? Is this what Torah is? I got a couple nods. More nods. That's nice.
Just one thing. It's something different to everybody. And even momentarily, a word is something different to the individual reading it. The vast thing.
So the answer, so one of the answers could be, and I'm using very careful language if I can keep being conscious of it, is yes, this is Torah, because what isn't? Right? Okay?
I'm wondering if what his influences were, I mean, a little bit of a sample by Cook, kind of seeing everything as potentially
holy.
How did he get to this kind of definition of Torah, given what you said about his
background? Was it
the university?
Was it some interesting
teaching?
Yeah. Not being a Heschel scholar, just being in love with him. The two books that I found most of my, not answer, but in response to my similar question, has been Aspaklaria, which is, he traces the schools of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael, who debated whether or not the Torah being given literally on Sinai was a tradition that wasn't modern. Was it actual? Did people believe in ancient times that the Torah was given literally? In it is a lot of his influence. In English, it was just released by Continuum Press 2 years ago, called Heavenly Torah, translated by Gordon Tucker, who's another Rebbe of mine. And the other place that I would look to is his book that deals with the Kutzke Rebbe and the Baal Shem Tov, Pursuit of Truth. Passion for Truth. Passion for Truth. In Search? No, Passion. Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, yeah, he does. He says he's doing the Kutzker and the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov had a joyous sense of the world, not ignoring the desperation and the sadness and the poverty that his community and he were subject to. And the Kutzker, who said, if you think you've got it good, you're a liar. Everything is awful, and you're going to return to worms. Your job is to make sure that you answer the will of God. Don't tell me you like Shabbos. That's not the point. Do it. And the Baal Shem Tov says, how could you do it and not experience rapture? And I think Heschel's torn between these things, because in the same way, and I was wondering if someone was going to point to this first, this says, the Torah's topic is the world, the whole of history, containing the pattern of a constitution of a united mankind, as well as guidance towards establishing such a union. It shows the way to nations, as well as to individuals. Well, what does it show in the conquest of Canaan? What does it tell us as Torah has been interpreted after it was already codified? What does it tell us about how to treat people who aren't Israelites? And it's conflicted there, as I think Heschel was too. He's telling the Torah that he thinks needs to be taught. That might have not have been grammatically correct, but you know what I meant. Martha?
When this asks a question,
good.
For example, it seems to you, you could be holy as God and holy as the people translated. It's a question without a direct answer. And without people like Heschel or Moshe or anybody throughout history, we wouldn't have known how to translate it into a life. We may all differ about how this happened, but most of us would agree about the values that it has provided us as a people.
Not going to call into question in an explicit way, but I would wonder that if we actually did some sort of real analysis of what we have gained from our relationship with Torah, I wonder if it would have, if there are probably two or three similar answers, and everything else would be wildly different. I don't know. I think we would have similar things like, we are together in a purposeful community that celebrates each other, supports each other, and reaches towards the unseen. Tries to promote a world into being that isn't yet, but we think should be. You know, I think that you're right. I want to point to text 2 because it says something that you say, that you just said, I think, which is to say, without Heschel, you just said. So listen to this line, which is from the Cambridge Introduction to Narrative. A little bit of research, didn't have a lot of time. Narrative is a two-way street. Without our collaboration, there is no narrative to begin with. Without Heschel, this Torah that he just taught us wouldn't have been. Might not have been. Without our collaboration, there is no narrative to begin with, and if it is true, this is the part I like the most, if it is true that we allow ourselves to be manipulated by narrative, it is also true that we do manipulating of our own. I love that. I love that. Because unless we are willing to be open to this kind of a conversation, what's the point of it? It's just bagels and coffee. Now, that's not just anything. That's quite good. But, Rita, I don't want to, you know, minimize the work. Where's Martha? Thank you. Okay. But ultimately, this type of a conversation remains theoretical and uninteresting. There's no impact on the world. If what we do is we show up for it, we put the sheets down, that was great, go biking. But if what we do is we put this down after we ate and we got together and we go biking and we listen to the things around us, and when we pass somebody in university who's asking for money, we wonder about what our obligation is in the world again. If it makes us feel less deadened, it's because we don't want to feel dead in a world that needs us to be alive. To be collaborators in the text doesn't mean that we have to write our own commentary. It means that we have to live out the ideas that are born by the encounter with this thing. Now, this thing I just said as if it's one thing. For me, the Torah, and when you nodded, Judy, I already nod whenever I ask that sort of question. Is Heschel right? I was in a class taught by Rabbi Shai Held, where he's just a scholar of enormous proportion, and has a lot of friends who are scholars in the Buddhist tradition. And he said, Heschel keeps on saying there's this objective direction we're supposed to follow. God is there, just dig deep within you and in the world and you'll experience God. And Shai said, is Heschel a bully? Because the Buddhist doesn't see the world that way. Would Heschel say to the Buddhist, just dig deeper? And I doubt Heschel would, but Heschel's philosophy seems to say that. And so this thing is in fact our, let's just be personal about this, even if we share it, I'll say I. My need to hear a message like this from someone like Heschel, who lived Torah so completely. My need to have a mythic direction that can make sense of the world that I inhabit, that doesn't leave me off the hook, because if the world I inhabit doesn't need me, why am I? I need God to be saying, Ayeka, where are you? Now, is that all about me?
Yeah.
But I don't think that's because I'm Menachem. I think that's because I'm a human being. And when we are open to the obligation that we have to the world, we wonder what that obligation is, and we look for guidance, and maybe we see it through the prism of certain interpretive traditions. Maybe that's why this building needs to have these windows, so that we look out all the time. Maybe. That's my mythic understanding of a glass.
On a simple level, though, you know, with that question about sign language Exodus, you know, I think about Babylon, Exile coming to an end and people coming back to the land, and I think of the Russian exile coming back to the land, and the Ethiopian exile with the operation Exodus, and even it, or whatever you want to call it, I think it's literally what they're called that comes.
Yes.
The concept of being an exile and coming back. It's just reverberating things, as it says, through the ages, throughout our world.
Yes, but. And I'm not pointing to you, Barry, but I'm just using you. The calm with which you just told that narrative of suffering tells us a few things. One is we're comfortable with that idea because that's our story. It has not been an easy story, no matter which epoch of history we're talking about. But the challenge of telling that story so much is that it becomes, this is Malcolm Gladwell's language, it's the law of immunity. You get so many emails about the same thing, you begin ignoring them, even if the emails are coming from Ruth Messenger and they're about Darfur. You know, green, it's a banner. Okay, I saw it. I'm just driving down the street. It's a homeless person on the street. I see so many of them. I don't know what they're going to do if I stop to help them. It's dark. I feel scared. What's the story I tell myself because of how many times I've watched Law and Order? Right. So at a certain point, I think the challenge of familiarity is that we need to recognize that our telling of the story isn't actually the complete story. Now, I know you and I agree on that, but the challenge of this is, well, I'm a collaborator in the story, but I can't just be a receiver. But look at the very next text. It's an unconventional one for this, but I'd like to lock on it in a second. This is from Honoring the Stories of Illness. It's a tremendous, tremendous piece. If you haven't read this book, it's not necessarily easy to read, but it's one of those that's very, very good. The power of narrative to affiliate into community and hence to amplify power on behalf of those who suffer. The narrative makes me feel pain. Narratively obtained knowledge of the other, especially the other who has suffered pain of trauma, can serve to improve health in the widest, most global frame by harnessing narrative as a force for freedom. Which is to say, when I talk about God taking us out of Egypt, what I'm actually saying is, that's the other, even though it's also me. I can tell the story in Pesach, because when I close the Haggadah, the narrative doesn't have to continue. But by reading the story of who I was, in that religious sense, meaning I was taken out of Egypt, I recognize that I don't know what anything looked like there. I don't know what it felt like there. But when I read the story, the other, which is part of me, comes more alive. It's similar, I guess, to what Moses, in the DreamWorks vision of the story, to what Moses felt when he was walking through the slaves' quarters of the Israelites, before he knew that he was one, he encountered Miriam and Aaron. And Miriam and Aaron said, "Don't you know? You're a slave." And you watch his face. In fact, that's one of the reasons that DreamWorks is the most powerful midrash on this story that has come alive, at least for many, many, including me, in the last while. You watch Moses' face in these moments of transformation, when he encounters the bush, when he finally realizes who he was, when he puts his hand on the hieroglyph story of his own saving and the death of all the other babies. Everything changes, I think, for the viewer, because suddenly you've got an image, even if it's Val Kilmer's voice, even if it's Sandra Bullock as Miriam, no matter what the limitations of the story might be, suddenly we see Moses coming alive with a part of him that he didn't know. And the power of mythic conduct, I'm just cutting a little bit to the next one, the power of mythic conduct is that all of a sudden I can't forget the totality of who I'm called to be in the world. If I was oppressed, I can't become deadened at the 17th email in 2 days from Ruth Messenger. I can't see the difference, and I should not see the difference, between the people suffering genocide in Darfur and the way I tell the story of my own people suffering genocide. Now, I'm an illegitimate bearer of both messages because I myself physically have no idea what I'm talking about. I will not ever have the capacity to understand these stories, for which I'm profoundly grateful. But the challenge, I think, that Heschel points to, that Abbott points to, though they probably didn't know each other, that Taryn, I think is how you pronounce her name, is pointing to as well, is that the power of these stories is that they're awful. They're full of awe. They're full of pain. They're full of suffering. Standing at the foot of a mountain, we're not going to get to it, so let me just read one section of Exodus 19. This is the section right before we receive the Torah in Parshat Yitro. This is the very end of how we prepare. This is before we get those 10 of the many commandments. Adonai said to Moshe, go get down. But then come up you and Aaron with you, but the priests and the people must not break through to go up to Adonai, lest God burst out against them. That is not a pleasant experience. And that is the moment that the mystics saw as the ultimate union of love between us and God. But that moment is full of pain, is full of fear. Standing at the base of the mountain, for the classic rabbis in the Talmud, standing at the base of the mountain meant God was holding it above our heads, saying, you want the Torah? Great. If not, this will be your grave. That's the language of the Talmud. But the very next sentence says, well, that's an argument for not accepting it. Because that's an agreement under duress. It doesn't hold. That's not relationship. That's not covenant. And what the mystics did in later tradition is they turned the ominous mountain hanging over our heads into a chuppah, into a wedding canopy, under which God stood with us. And the Torah became our ketubah. But if there is a better mythic re-understanding of an earlier mythic re-understanding of an encounter encapsulated by text as terrifying, I don't know one. Yes. I could not have said it better, and boy do I wish you were holding that mic, but I'm going to try to say what you just said. Mythic narrative is actually not the text. It's relationship with the text. Right? Because it's a narrative. It's a story. What Heschel sort of says, it's not. Torah is not a story. Torah is, you know, self. I mean, this whole internality thing. But Heschel probably couldn't see himself as distinct from Torah.
Our relationship
right. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes.
So to me, that's why I don't get the reign of science and historiography in terms of any of this stuff. To me, I don't care.
Right.
I don't care if there was a real story. I don't care if it was a real science. To me, they're just stories. They're just stories. It's everything. To me, it's like everything.
They're just stories until relationship, right? See, by the way, and I'm imagining that riled you up just a second, because they're just, you don't mean it, and I know that you heard it differently, so I'm just pointing it out. You said they're just stories, but you didn't mean just. When I yelled at Gilman, and I said, don't tell me they're myths, they're not just myths. He said, they're not just anything. Because the point of the story is to infiltrate me. I should be upset. Levinas says, I forget what the phrase he uses, is that the difference, and I think I spoke about this here before, the difference between a chair and a human being, Levinas didn't invent this example, is that when the chair is turned around, and I walk in the room from over here, I see the back of the chair, but I know what's on the other side. But, I'm using Michael, when I walk into the room and I see the back of someone's head and I think they're happy, but then I come around and I see that he's, you are happy. But when I see that he's not, I get mad because I couldn't predict it. I think it's predictability. There's another phrase for it. But the encounter with something I can't predict, with someone I can't predict, is what sets me off and makes me wonder about my place in the world, because if I don't own that aspect, I don't understand it fully, and it calls me to do something. And so the question is, when I see someone lying down in the street, and I'm walking to shul, and it's Shabbat, and I don't have any money, and I'm with my kids, and I want to be there for this other human being, and I don't know what to do, what do I do? I could just walk by, try to distract my children to look at something across the street. Is that what I'm supposed to do? And that, you know, one of my children is almost three. What am I supposed to do? I think ultimately one of the things I'm supposed to do is not ignore, no matter what. I'm supposed to feel incredibly pained. Either because I can or can't, and even if I do something, I'm not doing everything.
Or at the very least, make eye contact.
Right. Right. So what I want to remain open, what I want to not close off by this conversation, is the answer to that question. But the way you're saying it, I think it's very honest. The Torah should be no different to me than the person I pass on the street. Because they're just a person. They're just another person. And the answer is no, they're not. They're it, Martin Buber would say, until I recognize that they're more than something objective. They're not an extension of my understanding of the world. They are their own subject. They are a thou. I thou. I am in relationship with the other, and the other calls me to recognize that I am not it, and tells me by its very existence what I'm supposed to do. Even if I don't understand the call. The Torah calls me to respond even if I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but what I'm not supposed to do is not respond. If I can remain calm, I'm doing the wrong thing. Rita.
I love this quote also in terms of the collaboration there. I just want to juxtapose that, infuse it with two other possibilities that exist as a tension. One is that collaboration or co-creation. One is the possibility of truth, and the other is the possibility of fact and the weaving of all of those together.
Right.
As a psychotherapist, for example, I had a client who for years carried the narrative that she was bit by bees and her family did nothing about it. Hmm. Later on, she found out it was her sister who was bitten by the bee. But it didn't change the narrative of what she was holding. It changed the facts. It didn't change the truth. It did change the narrative. It didn't change the truth for her, what she was holding about her family. So there's a certain complex weaving of all of those, not all of those aspects.
Wow. Where my memory might not actually be what happened to me.
Right, but she was carrying something that conveyed the truth of the story, even though the facts were wrong.
There's just as a reference, I don't know if you've seen it, there's a book by Ann Ersu called Spilling Clarence, where I think I've spoken about it before. There's a chemical spill in the town, and the chemical releases memory. You can't hold back your memories. And people begin misremembering quite clearly, and someone who's suffered the loss of his wife actually locks himself in a room because suddenly he's with her again. But then his daughter begins, and the youth experiences last, but terribly, because they're exposed to so many stories, they don't know whose is whose anymore. It's fascinating. I'm not happy. Right. Right. And I would say, although that's not the point of this one, the health of forgetting a little bit. I don't know what to do with that in this conversation, but Jake.
To me, that's one of the most important pieces about following this myth. Because we all carry some story there. Either we leave it or acknowledge it or not. We're living some sort of story, some sort of belief, some sort of sense of who we are. And the most useful thing you can do in life is to know what that story is and choose whether we want to continue living that story or live some other story.
Yes.
And the story that we choose is what the story is.
Yes.
And we chose this story because it's in us, and we have the option of continuing to live along this story or go with the Buddhist story.
Yeah. I made the mistake of putting this out. I don't want this to go out yet. I was going to tell people it's okay. No, it's for you, but not yet. what Jake said included the idea that this is the story that we've chosen, or that has chosen us. And what I see actually as the role, and this is, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to even say this, let alone feel it healthily in the world. But I think that what modern faith communities have as their responsibility in the world, what places that are not fundamentalist in their vision of truth or history or them being the same, what we have as an obligation in the world is to perpetuate the comfort that the word myth can provide and to strengthen the link it gives to that very faith tradition, which is to say, I think this is a healthy way of living a Jewish life. I don't think it's the only way to live a Jewish life, and I don't think it's the only healthy way to live a Jewish life. But I think that what we begin to accomplish here, what we at least set out to do as a community, is to create a meeting point for many different people without telling them who to be, and yet always choosing the story. We davened before we learned here. Some of us. And we said words that are rooted in an ancient tradition that speak a theology that not everyone who even showed up for davening accepts. Except that we were all there, sort of facing forward together, facing east. And I think that if we could extend that into the world, it would become more healthy, not because it would think the way we do, but because it would provide a structure for imagining together what it would be to live in a world where people were less alone. And if that's the only contribution we made to the world, I think we've done a great service. It's not the only thing we contribute to the world. I think Heschel would call us to do that and cry too. But to not spend all of our time crying, it's to cry while we're doing good. And to certainly never feel dead as we encounter things that need us not to be. At a very basic level, I think that's the point of at least what I want to be saying. And to do that with Jewish soul, well then that's, you know, a continuation of being brought out of Egypt. I want to race through these last two texts, not imagining that we're putting closure on the conversation, but because if we don't do it, we're just missing two very nice texts. And when we're done, these salmon-colored copies are Everett Fox's translation of chapter 19 of the book of Shemot, of the book of Exodus, no less than our own Robert Alter, Uri Alter, who's a member of our shul, said on the back of the of this translation when it first came out, until he came out with his own, he said this. Fox's translation has the rare virtue of making constantly visible in English the distinctive Hebraic quality of the original, challenging preconceptions of what the Bible is really like, a bracing protest against the bland modernity of all the recent English versions of the Bible. When he came out with his own, I'm sure Fox said something nice in the back of his. But this is a place where the text rarely allows you to remain calm. Where when you read the translation, it's emphatic all the time, even when it's not. So, here are the last two quotes. There's a lot to say about them. We won't have time to really elaborate, but I wanted to at least share them out loud and use them as a gift back, saying thank you for allowing this conversation to continue, specifically to Art, for making sure the conversation continues. This is a really special opportunity for me, at the very least, and I'm glad to share it with us. Jacob Neusner, in his Classics of Judaism, says that the second trait of any book of Judaism, therefore, this is part of a larger section, concerns how it makes sense, by which I mean how sentences hold together to form coherent thoughts. Some books present propositions, evidence, and arguments, so they make points the way argumentative books do. Right? Make it fact, base it in the fact. It's irrefutable. That's my argument. That's one. Others tell stories. And so sentences hold together through the power of narrative. Right? The reason why this holds together is because it's a story. It has narrative tension. I hold you till the very end. There's no synthesis until I want the book to end. That's the power of the story. But the story then has an end. Still others may conduct a systematic and consistent reading of some prior text so that the authors make their points by saying the same thing about many things over and over again, which is, let's say you set out to talk about the origins of the Torah. And you trace it through the Mesopotamian Gilgamesh epic and the Numa Elish and all of the different things that we have in common as an ancient story with other ancient stories. You want to prove the etymological connections. Well, then you buy the JPS Torah commentary, and it's a very critical read. You read only the top commentary in our Eitz Chaim, the one that we use here, whereas it's a contextual reading. What does the text purport to say? I'm making an argument based on the text, and I'm trying not to put myself into it. These, Nusner says, are all familiar ways by which in our own time people write books. But, and this is my favorite part, but there is a fourth way, and that is not so familiar. Though for us in the room it might be a little bit. In this way, a prior text, for example, a chapter of Scripture or of Mishnah, will provide the framework and structure that holds together different thoughts that do not relate to one another, but do amplify sentences in that prior framework or structure. In simple terms, we should call that a commentary. That is, a piece of writing that not only comments on a prior writing, but also depends on that prior writing for sense and coherence. That Menachem's version of Neusner's take on commentary is that we have the power to look at Torah not only for what it was, but to look at Torah as a place that gives birth to a world that's supposed to be. We are collaborators in the ongoing narrative of Torah. And we are not out to only tell the story of where Torah came from. We're out to do what Heschel said at the very top. But Heschel also said that as an account of revelation, the Torah itself is Midrash. So I know that's a lot to say in a sentence. But as telling the story of the encounter with God, the Torah itself is Midrash. The Torah itself, I'm just saying it a different way now, the Torah itself is commentary on the relationship with God. Which means that Neusner says, well, you might have as your center Scripture or Mishnah, but what does Scripture, what does Torah have as its center? A relationship with God. Not literally described, but as an expansive, imaginative, sacred journeying with. Last quote. This is Joseph Campbell, who might not have liked the Jews that much. Just like my summing up of what was a very controversial narrative after he died, of what he might have done when he was alive. So I'm not giving birth to rumor, just saying I read one. A myth is different from a dream. Because a dream is a personal experience of that deep, dark ground that is the support of our conscious lives. Get ready for rereading this some other time, but got to throw it out there. And a myth is the society's dream. The myth is the public dream, and a dream is the private myth. If your private myth, your dream, happens to coincide with that of society, you're in good accord with your group. If it isn't, you've got an adventure in the dark forest ahead of you. If your private dreams are out of step with the public, you'll be in trouble. If you're forced to live in that system, you'll be an neurotic. Many visionaries and even leaders and heroes are close to the edge of neuroticism. They've moved out of the society that would have protected them and into the dark forest, into the world of fire, of original experience. Original experience has not been interpreted for you, and so you've got to work out your life for yourself. Either you can take it, or you can't. You don't have to go far off the interpreted path to find yourself in very difficult situations. The courage to face the trials and to bring a whole new body of possibilities into the field of interpreted experience for other people to experience, that is the hero's deed. What I want to suggest in closing is that what I love most about what we do here, and what I think Judaism in many, many wide swaths has the power to do, and sometimes it does, and what I think Christianity, when it does its best, does, and Islam, when it does its best, does, and agnosticism and atheism at their best do when they succeed, is point out the fact that original experience makes us feel alone, but it's quite powerful and dangerous. But when we can make sure that the deepest experience we have of the world is shared and adds health to the world, then it's sacred, then it's mythic, then it's a narrative. I happen to find myself in this home, in this family, And I think there's deep Torah to be shared from within it also. But the challenge is, if I think that it's fact, then I think that my relationship with God likely is not only unique, but better. And the last thing the Torah should lead us to do, which I mean to say, the last thing we should ask the Torah to teach us to do, is to make us feel separate or better than the people around us. If I'm looking for the way I think Netivot Shalom, and I know that this is a little bit brazen, but I think the way we model what Judaism is supposed to be for the world is by making sure that we would never build a wall through which we couldn't see the world. Because then we don't let God in either. Every step, every choice we take individually or as community is an expansion of the very Torah that we inherit, just as I believe, at least. The Torah is an expansion of that relationship into words which are limited, but give us a place from which to start. It's stable because not everything changes at the same time. Because then I can feel less alone knowing that there's someone to hug me, because we'll show up at some point. So may we have more moments like those. May we have a lot of moments like those. And may the Torah we share bind us together so that we can be stronger to give back to the world. Boker Tov.